Good evening. Welcome to the third lecture in our Schoenweis lecture series. Great Yasher Kayach, and thank you, Dr. Rosenbaum and Yom Gizel Shamri Amuna, for their very wonderful partnership, the Chlal V'Prat, in this lecture, and then all the classes and lectures and programs that we merit to do together. Big Yasher Kayach to you. Shalom Bayis, we all know of its importance, how integral it is to our family, to our happiness. Look a little deeper, look at Chazal, talks about Zacha, Ish v'Isha, if they merit the Shechina, and Tshuya b'Neihem. There's a lot of comparisons in Chazal and the Rishonim to a Mikdash, like a temple. Why is that? That harmony between man and woman is something that brings down the divine presence. We heard that before. But what's really the reason for that? Why does it have such a powerful effect? We looked at the Torah for the first insight into marriage. We look at Adam, all the way at the beginning of Genesis. It says that God created Adam levadai. Hashem saw it wasn't good to be levadai by himself. Adam should be alone. And he says, Eza Esalai, Eza Kenegdai, he'll make a helpmate. What was so bad to be alone? Chazal tell us that Adam had, you know, full service over there. The Malachim were taking care of all of his needs. He was like an angelic figure being served by angels. Sounds like the good life. What was missing? We know the tachlis of this world, of being here, is to become daima HaKadosh Baruch Hu, comparable to Hashem, mahu af ata, just like He is righteous, He is kind, so too we are kind, we are chanan, we are racham. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw, perhaps this is the meaning of the pasuk, that Adam was levada, he was by himself. He didn't have somebody to give to. And that's the meat of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, that's why we're here. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to be native, to do kindness, to do good. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that for the tachlis of the Bria, it was necessary for Adam to have, in that single unit, to have a person that he could give to, Ish v'Isha, that they could give to each other. For that's the very tachlis of life, is to be able to give. And that way we could be daima to Hashem. When we do that, so it's no wonder why the Shechina, the Divine Presence, rests among this unit. A very powerful thought. We think about some of the strife, some of the challenges that we have in marriage. If we think about the whole tachlis of marriage is not for our own benefit, to have, to take, but to give would put marriage in a whole different perspective. We have a great honor tonight to hear words of wisdom and inspiration on this important topic from Rabbi Moshe Hauer, the Mor Da'atzov Congregation B'nai Jacob, Shai Zion in Baltimore, Maryland. Rabbi Hauer is an active and local communal leadership in many areas, with an emphasis on education and social service organization serving the Jewish community. He's a founding editor of the online journal Klal Perspectives, which I recommend reading for its great insights into contemporary matters that affect us all, and leads a leadership training program for rabbis and communal leaders. He lectures on a wide variety of topics in Jewish law and thought, including support groups for families and individuals, facing traumatic illness, infertility, and special needs. Rabbi Howard is well known as a passionate supporter and advocate for Israel. He's also vice president of the Baltimore Vada Harbanim. His counsel and leadership are sought on a wide range of communal matters. And it's a great honor tonight to introduce Rabbi Howard as our speaker.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Winter. Appreciate the invitation to be here and appreciate the introduction. I especially ask the reshus of your friend and colleague, Gemara D'Asra, Rabbi Rosenbaum. It's an honor and an unexpected honor that you are here. In fact, it's unexpected to me that any of you are here. If this is a Shalom Bayis series and it's 3 weeks before Pesach and all you people are here, maybe I'll sit down and you can lecture to me about this. That's surely quite something. You know, you're supposed to start, Chazal teach us that we're supposed to start any kind of a shiur or lecture with a joke. The problem when you're speaking about Shalom Bayis is that all the jokes about marriage are cynical. They're cynical, and I always like to discourage people, don't make cynical jokes about marriage, unless they're really funny. Tonight's topic that Rabbi Winter asked me to speak about is the notion of two parts of a whole, of self-actualization in marriage. And Chazal famously teach us that a person is not called an Adam, a person is not called a person until doesn't achieve that completeness, until they merit to be married. Which of course leads to that statement with which I can begin this speech, that a person is incomplete until they are married, and once they are married they are finished. Okay, no more cynical jokes. The notion of two parts of a whole, the idea that a human being is in fact uniting with their wife, then v'hayu l'bas harecha, they become together, only together, two people like one, is a notion that can be approached on many levels. It can be approached on all kinds of mystical levels, deep philosophical levels. I would like to use the time tonight that we have in discussing this idea of two parts of a whole and self-actualization in marriage by discussing perhaps the most basic aspect, the simplest aspect of this issue, one which I think I will be spending the bulk of my time really just amplifying on the beautiful thought which Rabbi Winter said in his introduction this evening. And the core of the idea is very simply as follows. If we are to view ourselves in relationship, in marriage, as two parts of a single whole, we are defining ourselves not in terms of ourselves alone. We are defining ourselves in terms of relationship. I am not just simply an individual. I am the father, the husband, the brother. I'm not complete. A freestanding individual self unit. I define myself in terms of others. If looking at myself without the other, I am incomplete, then I define myself in terms of others. And in that framework, we can accurately view the chosen relationship of marriage as the decision and the move to initiate and to create a relationship where we undertake full and complete responsibility for another person, to live together with that other person, to define their success, their thriving as ours, to share with them and to be completely relied upon. It's a little bit of an old-fashioned idea to have dedication to a relationship as a raison d'être, as a purpose, or perhaps even more than a purpose of our existence, to see our primary role that way. There's a favorite article that I call upon in my own reminding of myself of some of the challenges of society often. It's an article that was published in The Atlantic some years ago called "Is Facebook Making Us Lonely?" And in there, there's a paragraph which I would like to just share with you because it says it. It says it very clearly, and it speaks with a breadth and literacy that I will not claim as my own. Today, the one common feature in American secular culture is its celebration of the self that breaks away from the constrictions of the family and the state, and in its greatest expressions from all limits entirely. The great American poem is Whitman's Song of Myself. The great American essay is Emerson's Self-Reliance. The great American novel is Melville's Moby Dick, the tale of a man on a quest so lonely that it is incomprehensible to those around him. American culture, high and low, is about self-expression and personal authenticity. Franklin Delano Roosevelt called individualism the great watchword of American life. To pursue the self, to pursue self-satisfaction. Struggles which people face in relationships and decisions which people make in the context of those struggles are so often the struggle between a self-actualization that is separate and apart from relationship altogether. And it seems that in this realm, things have changed a bit. I want to tell you a little story that I heard once from someone. His name is Yaakov Solomon. He's a counselor in the New York area. He speaks a lot. He's a good, very, very fine speaker and teacher. And he tells a story that is a classic expression, I think, for many of us, of a certain sense of the difference. He was taking his child to summer camp, to the bus to summer camp. And they had the instructions on whichever morning, Tuesday morning, they're supposed to bring the kids to the corner of this street and this avenue where the bus would bring the children, would pick up the children to take them to sleepaway camp for the summer. As happens in many of these camp situations, you know, you send your luggage, the kids send their luggage a day or two before on a truck because the bus couldn't hope to fit it all. And the next day, they're coming, he's bringing his child to the location. And sure enough, whatever the time was in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, he comes, drives his son, he comes to the street corner. And he sees a few kids standing in this little parking lot on that street corner. And he looks at them, and he says, "I don't think I'm at the right place." He rolls down his window. He says, "Excuse me, is this where the bus is supposed to be picking up for Camp So-and-so?" And they say, "Yes, sure." You're going to that camp?" "Yes." "Yeah." "Where are your parents?" They brought us here. They dropped us off." And he said to himself, he says, you know, he remembers that when he went to summer camp, his father took him to the bus. And his father parked his car and waited for him till the bus came. And when the bus came, he saw him onto the bus, made sure that he was settled in, and waited until the bus left. And when the bus left, his father went running after the bus, and he would throw candies into the open window that his son had by his seat. And he was stunned. His kids are going away for a month or two, and the parents drop them off, and say goodbye. At a different time, not so long ago, people perhaps defined themselves that much more, identified themselves that much more as the father or the mother of their children, as the husband or as the wife, invested their identity in that. And as time has gone on, long after Emerson and Whitman, the ideals, the nature of things, it seems, has shifted a little bit. It's much more difficult to find, much more unusual in a sense, to find that kind of definition of self. Hear this all the time from educators, from people involved in things like summer camps and the like, that the greatest struggle sometimes, or the greatest sense, is that when the school year starts, the parents are able to breathe a sense of relief, a sigh of relief. Ah, someone else can take care of them now. And the sense, rather than, you know, offering an opportunity, is being able to go back to our own opportunities, to our own direction. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when Hashem created us in this way, that there is to be a sense of incompleteness, a sense of two parts, two halves of a whole, that a person is incomplete without the other. He's building into us this idea, this self-definition, which we are to have, of being defined in terms of a relationship with somebody else. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, we have from him a sefer called the Nefesh HaChaim. Rav Chaim of Volozhin was the great student of the Gaon of Vilna. And the children of Rav Chaim Volozhiner wrote the introduction to this book. And the son writes and he says, V'koy hoya devorai elai tamid. He says, this is what he would tell me all the time. This is what our father used to tell us all the time. Sheze kol ha'adam. This is all that man is about. Lo la'atzmo nivra. A person wasn't created for their self. Rak lahoy la'achrini b'chol asher yimtza b'kocho lasos. Just to be able to help others, to assist others in any way that they have the power to do so. The definition, the actualization of self, the purpose of existence, is for somebody else. It can create a little bit of a philosophical conundrum. If everybody is created for somebody else, then what's it all about? Everyone's for the next person? But in a certain sense, yes, as Rabbi Winter alluded to in his introduction, yes, that is what it's all about. That self-actualization. In a certain sense, if we can speak about divine self-actualization, if we could speak about the Ribono Shel Olam, God Himself, trying to actualize. Again, a philosophical difficulty to speak about Hashem, so to speak, missing anything. But He wanted to create a world so that there would be others out there that would benefit from the ultimate goodness that He had to offer. Hashem, so to speak, had to complete His picture by being meitiv lezulaso, by giving and sharing with another, by having another that existed on His account. And so, for us human beings created in His image, that's exactly the model. That's what we're created for. To have that same sense that our self-definition is really, in a sense, a misnomer. Our self-definition is our definition of ourselves in relation to others. What we can do, where we can be, how we can be there for somebody else. There's a Rambam at the end of the Laws of Purim. Perhaps you've heard it, and perhaps you've heard it recently. This Rambam is a Rambam to not just recall in the weeks before and after Purim. It's a Rambam to live with. It's a Rambam to put as a little plaque on your desk or on your refrigerator. The Rambam writes, what should a person do? There's lots of mitzvahs for us to perform on Purim. There's a mitzvah of having a suda, of having the festive meal of Purim. There's a mitzvah of mishloach monos. And there's a mitzvah of the gifts to the poor of matzanos levyonim. Where should the lion's share of our investment go? Should one of these mitzvahs get more attention than the rest? And the Rambam says yes. And it would come to seem as no surprise. He says, the gift to the poor should get the lion's share. It's a mitzvah laharbais. Mutav lodam laharbais matanes lev yainim mi laharbais bisudasu vishleach manes lereyav. It is better to give more to the poor than to give more on your own meal or for your friend. Now, we would do this interactively, I would say, so tell me why. Why would you think that that's the case? Why would it be better to give gifts to the poor than to give to your friends or to spend on your meal? And he would say, that's really a silly question. It's obvious why. Because the poor really need it. Your friends are going to be spending the next 3 weeks figuring out how to get rid of it before Pesach. And your own suda, there's a question. It should be better to spend more money so you can have a nicer meal, or that you should give something to somebody who really needs. It's obvious. It's a much bigger mitzvah to give to the poor. The Rambam doesn't say that predictable explanation. The Rambam says a completely and totally different explanation, and his explanation is that the mitzvah of the day of Purim is to rejoice. The mitzvah is simcha. How do you greet people on Purim? Afreilich and Purim, Simchat Purim, whatever your choice, Happy Purim. It's a day of Mishte v'Simcha. Says the Rambam, get the most Simcha bang for your buck that you can. So when you look at the various mitzvahs of Purim, all of which are mitzvahs of Purim, think which one is going to bring you the greatest happiness. And says the Rambam, Ein sham simcha gedolo umefora. There is no greater or more glorious joy. Ela l'sameach lev aniyim v'yesomim v'almonos v'gerim. More than bringing joy to the hearts of the poor, of the lonely, of the stranger. Sham sameach lev hoim lolim ho'elu daime l'shchina. Because one who brings joy to such people is emulating God. Shenemar lahachios ruach shvolim lahachios lev nitkoyim. As Yeshaya describes, that's what God does. He revives the spirits of those who are lonely and down. And so to do that, to bring that joy to someone who really needs it, will give you the greatest possible feeling in the world. Because, after all, that's what you're here for. That's what Hashem made you for. We all know, we always try when we think about people, we say, what should they be doing? How should I train my child? I want to find who they are, what their dominant strengths and interests are, and let them find their way exactly as an individual. Because we know the greatest satisfaction anybody has is when they do what they were made to do. Well, if there's a generic what we were all made to do, what is it? To help others. To be there for other people. So much so, indeed, that to our subject of two halves of all of self-realization, self-actualization in marriages, because that's where it's not an activity for Purim afternoon. It's not an episode of volunteerism or of goodwill. But it's a relationship which is life itself. You know, we have many, many times that the Torah gives us special cautionary warning about how we're supposed to treat the yosom, the orphan. there's a very simple question that we have to wrestle with, however, and that is, what is the definition of a yosam, of an orphan? A yosam, obviously, is someone who's lost a parent, or, heaven forbid, both parents. How about a 87-year-old person who lost their parents at the age of 105? A yosam. Is that what the Torah is referring to? What's the definition of a yosam? The Rambam writes about this in Hilchos Deos. After he speaks about all the great care we have to exercise with a person who's orphaned, he says, "Ad emasai nikroim yosamim linyan zeh." Till when is a person categorized as a yosam, as an orphan? Is a yosam at any age, halachically speaking? And writes the Rambam, "Ad shelo yutzrichim la'adam gadol yisamech alav ula'amnon uli'tatul b'hem." When a person reaches an age where they're not reliant on someone who they can lean on, someone who will train them and work with them and concern themselves with them, but they can be independent and do all kinds of things for themselves like regular adults. At that point, the definition of yosom ceases to apply to that person. Now, of course, on some level, any person, that 87-year-old who lost their 105-year-old parents, feels absolutely orphaned. But the special care the halacha applies to the yosom is the one who lives in a relationship still reliant on the parent, not independent in that way. I don't know if the Rambam is giving here more the definition of a yosam, of an orphan, than giving the definition of a parent. The definition of a parent and the definition of a spouse, because the same rules apply as well to the almana, is that we are defined as people on whom others rely. Not as an occasion, not as a matanos levyonim or a visit to a lonely person on Purim, but our place as a human being, when we enter into such relationships, the relationship of a parent or the relationship of a spouse, is about defining for ourselves, expanding for ourselves, the world of our responsibility, the world of those who now have us as a critical piece in the infrastructure of their lives. And that is fulfillment, is tachlis, is purpose, to play that role. Self-actualization in terms of being there absolutely for somebody else. The Arizal of Yitzhak Luria was the great, great Kabbalist, the father, in a certain sense, of the Kabbalah, the way we have it. And he had a student who committed most of the writings that we have are from him, from a Chaim Vital. Chaim Vital, who was a great Kabbalist in his own right. Chaim Vital said the following. I've searched to find this in his works, of which I'm no expert. I know it, I haven't found it. I know it only because it was cited by Rav Shlomo Volba, Zichrono Livracha, in his writing. And he says as follows, Chaim Vital says as follows, and this is something only a great Kabbalist could know, and something which, when we think about it, every one of us could well imagine. He said, a person will come after 120 years before the Rabbona Shalom, to the pearly gates, whatever you want to call them. And he's going to be ready. He'll say, I have my case prepared. He'll come to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and say, okay, please, tell me. I gave you life on this world. Tell me what you did. Tell me what you accomplished. And the person will start off and they'll say, you know, there was a Chevra Kedisha in our town. It was understaffed. And I got involved. I was involved in helping to put, and Hashem will say, excuse me 1 second. Please stop. Nice. Chevra Kedisha, Tzedakah, Chesed, everything else. First, please tell me about how you were at home. What kind of a husband were you? What kind of a father were you? What kind of a child were you? What kind of a sibling were you? Tell me about that. And says Rav Chaim Vital, when the person finishes presenting about that, Hashem, if Hashem is satisfied, he'll say, okay, now tell me about the other stuff. But if he's not satisfied with that stage, Hashem doesn't want to hear anymore. We have an expression in our vernacular that charity begins at home. And it begins at home because home is where the real relationships are. And relationship is responsibility. And our first role is to live to fulfill that profound responsibility, which we welcome and undertake when we become a part, when we make ourselves a part of the fabric of somebody else's life. I would like, share with you 3 specific points which derive, in some cases a little bit more, in some cases a little bit less, but from what we've been talking about here. But there are 3 points which I feel are very important to share. And I try to share them honestly whenever speaking about subjects relating to marriage. It used to be 2 points, and in the past several years, there's a third, which will be number 2. The first point is one which I feel is really, to in a sense, goes to the essence of the satisfaction, or heaven forbid, the pain that we experience in our relationships of marriage. I'm a congregational rabbi. I spend time, a nice chunk of time, with people talking about their marriages, talking about their relationships. And after a number of years of doing that, it seemed to me that with all the different tips and pointers and aspects and things that people have to be aware of in marriage, and there are, of course, many, in a certain sense, there's a klal gadol, the marriage. There's a single, so to speak, rule, which it somehow all seems to come back to. And that is the following. Why do people get married? Why do people get married? People get married because they don't want to be alone. That's what the Chumash said, you know, also, you know, lo tov heyos adam levado, it's not good for a man to be alone. But when we think back and put ourselves back, those of us who have the privilege of being married, think back and you say, you know, there I was, and I had a family, perhaps I blessed with a family, with loving parents, with siblings, with friends, maybe roommates and apartment mates and all kinds. But on some level, I was still very much alone. And then I met this person. and a level of sharing, of personal, intimate sharing developed. I really, really shared and developed a sense of connection to that person. And we do that when we marry. We go up on a limb, we go out on a limb to some degree. We make ourselves vulnerable in that sharing. And then life continues. And every time we experience something in life together, not necessarily a dramatic event, just another day. Every time, you know, we might come home from a long day or have someone come home to us after our long day. And the other person notices that it's been a long day and expresses interest to hear about the long day or expresses readiness to say, you know, it's been a long day. What, maybe let me take care of that. That's the satisfaction. When we do something, experience something positive, and share it, that's the satisfaction of marriage. And the pain in marriage is when, after all that, we feel completely alone. Maybe just for an hour. Maybe someone came home and they had a hard day, or they're busy with something, and they didn't even notice that I'm also having a hard day. Or I'm going through something, and it's so important to me, and my spouse doesn't get it. They don't feel it. They don't have the same sensitivity to the issue. They don't realize what's bothering me. And somehow I just can't get through, or they're not listening or open to get through. That's what the pain in marriage comes down to. I've tried this thesis on lots of people. I'm not going to ask in a big room for people to nod their heads, but usually when I'm sitting and talking to someone, I say, is this right? And it's right. I think it's correct. And so, what I think is principal for us in our minds as husbands and wives is to recognize that this is our mandate. If I'm going to be a good husband, my job is to make sure that my wife doesn't feel alone. As much as possible, never feels alone. Whether it's on the, so to speak, relative trivialities of cleaning for Pesach. Excuse me for referring to that as a relative triviality. Or for a more substantive and life-altering issue, an issue with family, an issue with career, an issue with whatever. My job as a husband is to make sure that I'm attuned to what my wife is experiencing in micro and macro, and to be in on it, empathetic to it, aware of it, and to whatever degree I can, sharing it so that she's not alone. And the same is true, of course, in the opposite direction. And if a person keeps that in their mind, my job is to make sure my wife doesn't feel alone. As they walk up the walkway to their house when they come home after a day, they say, you know, here I am. I have my own world that I occupied for all this time. But now, and maybe during that day as well, you know, the checking in, all the shtick, all the tricks, all the important things that we know that we don't need or we're not going to review. But this idea, again, remember, lo latzmo nivra. We're not created for ourselves. We're created to benefit others. And that's true generally, but in marriage, it's the contract. That's what we sign up for. We sign up to be there for the other. That is the job description. And it is in that that we will find that fulfillment, that divine fulfillment. The second point, which is just a continuation of this, is one which is, I think I feel necessary to always express in recent years. I just want to tell you the story which to me says it all. It's not about husbands and wives, it's about parents and children. The point applies to them all. I had the great privilege about a year ago to travel to Switzerland. I was invited there for something, and the people were very wonderful, and they invited my wife and I to come, and they helped me somehow to convince my wife to come, and to come. And we went to Switzerland, and I spoke someplace, and then they sent us off into the Alps. And they put us on a train which is recognized. It says all over on the tables in the train, is now like one of the UN world's most beautiful sites. I think it's the only decision of the UN I agree with since 1947. And this train travels through the mountains, through the Alps, most beautiful scenery in the world, and the train stopped at a station. And we're looking out the window. It's Sunday, like 11 o'clock in the morning. And it's springtime. There's melting snow forming a beautiful, beautiful stream cascading down a mountain. The mountains are already green, and there are two Swiss girls, as if they are dressed for a postcard. They're wearing nice skirts and bows and a bonnet, bonnets in their hair, maybe 7 years old and 5 years old. And there's a little low, you know, retaining wall at the foot of this hill, and they're doing what children do whenever they see such a thing. They're walking on top of it like on a tightrope, and their father is with them. And the children are skipping along, a beautiful scene, and the father is with them. And he's walking along like this. And about every 10, 15, 20 seconds or so, like the children are calling to the father, looks up, goes like this. But it's like, I mean, I didn't see it from where I was sitting in the train, but without question, with a certain glazed look in his eyes, and then right back there. You may not have seen the image with the beautiful postcard background, but you see it everywhere. We see it in ourselves everywhere. The challenge of presence, that these things and that the roving office has produced in life and in marriage and in relationships, is incredible. It's true on many levels, but for now and for tonight, we can speak of it only in terms of simply the one, the time and attention. Forget the relationship issues writ large that it creates, but just simply the distraction. How many people, in the middle of a conversation, right, we come home, we make a commitment. I'll tell you this: I struggle with this like everybody else. So I get home for dinner. We still have this mishigas called family dinner, and I'm very proud of myself. I got home and it was only 20 minutes later than I said that I was going to. And I sit down at the table, and we're ready to have dinner. And to talk, and we're talking and hearing. And a couple of minutes into the conversation, I feel this little buzz in my pocket. And nobody else feels the buzz, just I feel the buzz in my pocket. And the conversation continues, and my mind is already a little bit like, who, what was that buzz? Now, you know, I'm a rabbi, I have to be on call all the time, so I better just sort of like sneak a look at this right now. And like sort of like discreetly, like, yes, yes, right? You know the thing, right? And where am I? You know, it used to be that AT&T would advertise that, you know, a phone call, right, was it? It was the next best thing to being there. Now I think there should be a new advertising campaign. having your spouse at home with a telephone is the next best thing to actually having him there. And how we disappear. We disappear onto the computer and gone. You know, there used to be such a thing that 16 to 20 Sundays a year, depending on which city you lived in, there was such a thing called a football widow. Right? You've heard of it? Now, 365 minus 52 Shabbosos and a couple of Yomim Tovim, what do we have? We have email and the web, widows, orphans, widowers, because presence is greatly challenged. And if we're talking about living for somebody else, we're talking about making sure that somebody doesn't feel alone, somehow we've got to get a handle on this. We've got to adopt for ourselves some rules of the road. And finally, when we speak about two parts of a whole, there's no more literal presence of two parts of a whole than a child. Our children are literally comprised of their fathers and their mothers. As Rashi reads the Chumash, when it says, the man leaves his father and mother, attaches himself and his wife, they become like one, says Rashi, in the child. The child is comprised of a bit of the father and a bit of the mother, together in one package. Two parts of it. And if we talk about being there for somebody and being reliable and being loyal and defining our lives in terms of being there for somebody else, well, this relationship of husband and wife and its impact on how the child feels whole cannot be overstated. This is part of a series about Shalom Bayis. The principal dividend of Shalom Bayis is child rearing. And the first lesson of good child rearing, the first requirement of good child rearing, is to try every way you can to have the best Shalom Bayis. Because if we're going to speak figuratively in terms of ourselves and our spouses being two parts of one whole, for our child it's not figurative. For our child it's real. And when they see or feel tension between the two that are one in them, it's like you can almost picture this sort of internal tension threatening, heaven forbid, to disturb them and to tear them apart. And in terms of our responsibility, in terms of defining ourselves, in terms of being there for somebody else, well, that's what it's about. It's about giving that sense of security, that sense of security to our spouse, and that sense of security through that, critical sense of security to our children. That is the greatest self-actualization. I would like to end with a thought and with a story. The thought I would like to end with is the following. We're here in a shul. This is where we serve Hashem. We call it a Migdash Ma'at. We call it a small version of the temple. It's so different than the Beis HaMikdash that it's unimaginable. Not just in size, not just in location, not just in the fact that there are many shuls in one Beis HaMikdash. But think about the difference in how we serve Hashem now and how we served Hashem then. How do you serve Hashem now? What's a good avoda, what's a good method of worship? You come to shul and you ask Hashem for everything that you need. Right? We do the Shemana Esrei. We have the introductory brachas, we have the closing brachas, but in the middle we have 13 brachas, which are the laundry list, what Chazal composed for us, every different kind of thing, kol tzorchei adam, all the different needs that a person would have that they somehow distilled into this Shemoneh Esrei. And then we add our own. Whatever we need, we turn to Hashem. We ask, we ask, we ask. And that's davening. That's service of Hashem. And what was service of Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash? It wasn't about asking Hashem. You know what it was? The Beit HaMikdash, we built a house, so to speak, for Hashem to live in. V'asu li migdash v'shachanti b'socham. You'll build for me a migdash so I can have a place to live. And what do we do? What have we been reading about in the parshios these past couple of weeks? We feed him. We give lechem isher reach nichoach l'Hashem. We provide Hashem with room and board. Once upon a time, our service of Hashem was that we gave to him. Now, we don't understand what that means. As the Navi reminds us many times, am I hungry that you have to feed me, that you have to take care of me? We have to understand how it is, what it works, what it means, but those are the terms of the relationship. And now, we're just asking. And it tells us something. Because when we had the Beis HaMikdash was when we were a people that were actualized. A people that had achieved where we were supposed to be. And when the definition of our relationship is what you can do for me, what can I get from you? That's where we are in weakness. That's Golus. That's what we do now. It's a relationship. But it's not self-actualization. Self-actualization is what can I do for you? Self-actualization is ze kol ha'adam lo la'atzmo nivra. This is what man is about, not for ourselves, but to be able to do for others. And that will be the success and the fulfillment of our lives in relationship. And a story. A story that's hard to repeat for me without getting a little bit emotional, even though I didn't experience it myself. It's just such a striking story. I have a dear friend, a great man. His name is Dr. David Pelkowitz. I'm sure many of you know him or know of him. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. Person who gives of his time and his great wisdom in the field of mental health selflessly to the Jewish world. And he tells the following story. He participates regularly in the Chai Lifeline retreats for parents and their ill children. And he said at the first Chai Lifeline retreat, he was doing a group with a bunch of the kids who were themselves fighting illness. And they were seated in a room, seated around in a circle. And they were talking. They were talking about the challenges of what they experienced. And there was a boy, a Hasidic boy from a Hasidic family in Brooklyn. He was sitting in a wheelchair because he had lost one of his legs to cancer. And this boy, as everybody's speaking about the challenges, this boy said, no. He says, this was good. Good? He says, yeah. He says, I lost a leg. But you know what I got? He says, you know, before I got sick, my father, he worked very hard. He'd hardly ever be home for dinner. When he'd come home, he'd be distracted, busy. I hardly had time with my father. My siblings, the rest of the family, my mother, things were so busy and stressful. Everybody was always running around, getting in each other's way, yelling, screaming. Then I got sick, he said. Then I got sick. My father just zoomed to my side. He comes home. He's focused. He's attentive. My siblings suddenly they all get along. They all work together. Not just for me, but for each other. My mother, she's a different person. Focused, calm, with the environment around her so much better. I lost a leg, and I got a family. The difference we can make, being there, dedicated, focused, realizing that there's no joy in the world like bringing joy to someone who's lonely. And yes, again, it's true for our matanos le'avyonim or lonely mishloach monos recipient, beneficiary. But there are a lot of lonely people living in houses with lots of other people. And there's no joy, absolutely no joy, that compares to making sure that the people who you live with are not lonely. That they feel they have someone who they rely on, who thinks for them, who cares for them. That's self-actualization through marriage. To define ourselves and to fulfill ourselves and what we can mean for another. I hope and pray that Be'ezus Hashem, we should all merit to live up to that. That all those who yearn and wait for a day to Be'ezus Hashem be in a relationship of marriage should have that dream and that wish Be'ezus Hashem fulfilled in the richest of ways. We should all be zochah through the strengthening of our own individual familial home to the strengthening of our whole community and of our world. B'meirah B'yamim. Also, if somebody wants to raise their hand, that's also fine. Thank you. Yeah. The first question here is, when do you think the focus on self became so dominant? The story about the bus suggests that it became dominant about a generation ago. But the great American authors you cited, Thoreau, Emerson, Melville, wrote well over 100 years ago. Can you reconcile? Thanks. And I alluded to that slightly, that they were before this fellow was taking his kids to the bus. It would be a little bit out of place for me to do some major sociological analysis of something that I may not know. But I have one simple theory in that story itself that is the beginning of an approach, which is that story was not about an American. That father wasn't an American. That father was a European. You know, I grew up with European parents. It was a mindset that didn't know from the great watchword of individualism. And I think a lot of our Jewish community is colored by that to the extent that it's there internally. There's a lot which has been written in terms of sociological writing about how this has really developed far beyond Melville and Whitman, etc. There is a modern classic called Bowling Alone, of sociology. I know people have heard of it or read it, that chronicles how the breakdown of community and society and volunteerism that has happened along with the developments of television and the kinds of things where just had people just spend much more time alone in their homes and much less in bowling leagues and rotary clubs and all these kinds of things. Today, of course, we know that one of the greatest art forms is the selfie. So you know, it seems that it's a precipitous slide, but I feel in a great sense in our own life, in my own life, I feel that it's seeing the difference between, you know, the immigrant parents that we have and the change of the current generation. I don't know if that's correct. We were recently guests in someone's home. The woman was very warm and welcoming, and the husband, except for a brief moment, never looked up from his sefer, neither to his wife nor to his guests. Was she lonely? She might have been. She might have been very, very lonely. She might not have been lonely. I don't know. And I'll tell you why. You know what one of the most celebrated marriages of Jewish tradition is? Was the marriage of Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara speaks of the marriage of Rabbi Akiva and his wife. She's not identified in the Gemara by this name, but in other sources, Rachel, right? Bas Kalba Savua. One of the most celebrated marriages in Jewish life, lore and legend. And what did she say to her husband? She said, please go and learn. That's what I want you to do. To me, that's my fulfillment. And he went for 12 years, and you know the story, and then he came back. And he overhears his wife talking to the neighbor who says, you know, your father was right when he told you not to marry that peasant shepherd. Look, he just left you. Almonus chayus, he left you as a living widow, widow of the living, for 12 years. And she said, and evidently not defensively, but as sincerely as anybody could say anything, you know, if he would listen to me, he would stay for another 12. So Rabbi Akiva turns around, didn't even stop in for a cup of coffee, and went back for another 12 years. And when he came back, you know, the story, he came back with all his talmidim, and this woman comes to greet him, and she's dressed in tatters, and his bouncers, you know, they said, stay away, this is Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva says, no, you don't tell her to stay away. Shaliv shalachem shalohem. What's mine and what's yours are all hers. And I don't believe the wife of Rabbi Akiva was lonely. Oh, she would have loved to see her husband. She would have loved to see her husband. But not being alone doesn't necessarily mean that you're walking together holding hands all the time. Not being alone means that you're involved in life together. That what you're doing, wherever you're doing, is with me in mind. And not ignoring my wishes, but doing it. You're off there doing that thing. It's tricky. It's very likely, by the way, that the woman described in this picture was lonely, because many times people will escape. They can escape into a computer, and lahavdil elef alfi havdalot, they could also escape into a sefer, but sometimes they're doing exactly what their spouse wants them to do. And then nobody's lonely. Then they're fulfilled, and that's the team that is working together. So, I don't know. I don't know about that particular family. Please address shalom bayis when it conflicts with honoring one's parents. It's a very hard question, and it's not a question to which a single answer can be given. The Gemara speaks already about the notion of the conflict of shalom bayis with honoring one's parents. And it seems to put the precedence on shalom bayis, first, with some qualification. I will tell, again, I think the matters are very, very specific and very individual, but I will just share with you a way of thinking about this without trying to answer the question fully or, you know, claiming that this would answer the question fully, but just something to keep in mind in this realm. Shalom Bayis is about creating a home that's whole, a home that stays together, a home that understands what relationships are about. It's very hard. It's very hard to present that in a real way without modeling that. Many times people have great stresses with their parents who don't live in their house. They're married, they have parents someplace else. If the chosen method of dealing with those stresses, which is sometimes necessary, but if the chosen method of dealing with that stress is to say, you know, somehow I just can't have them in my life. Completely, partially, you know, some sense of distance. There is a cost that comes along with that. And you may not see the cost immediately. But what you're doing is, again, maybe you need to do it. But what you're doing is you're telling your child that a relationship with a parent can be or cannot be. It's not that a parent to a child to a parent, that's absolute. That's what we want to convey to our children, for ourselves. We want them to know that we're there for them absolutely, and we want them to feel towards us the same way. The only way that they can get that message loud and clear without a lot of static on the line is if they see that that's our parent-child relationship. That's our relationship with our parents. If we don't, it won't work. You know, I sometimes, you know, sit with somebody and they're telling me, ah, it's terrible, my children, they're not getting along with each other. This one is not speaking to that one. And, you know, very, very sympathetic. And sometimes I just like hold myself back and from saying, I understand, but excuse me, when was the last time you spoke to your sister? Like, people see from examples like that that these relationships are negotiable. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. So I can't answer on one foot the question of Kibud Av V'Em versus Shalom Bayis and so on and so forth. Shalom Bayis is critical, and Kibud Av V'Em to work it in, but recognize that our relationships with our families outside of our nuclear unit inside our house are going to be constantly instructing our children as to what a parent-child-sibling relationship is all about. And so keep that as a primary consideration in that process. In today's world, which between long work hours, long commutes, etc., what is the role of Torah learning versus time with a spouse? People ask very good questions. It's one which requires balancing. Again, it's not. They're both needs. They're both things which have to be done. A Jew has to learn Torah. I personally often advise people that it's very good to develop a habit where you learn Torah at 6 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning. Your wife will usually not miss you. She won't miss you. At 8:30, when everything's flying around and you say, oh, excuse me, I have to go to my chavrusa. You know, so then it's a little, you might think that the person's actually trying to get away from something. And it's really a qualitative thing. So to do it something like that where it's not in any which way an escape, and it won't cost if a person has the chance to choose, you know, I think that that's a good way to look at it. I don't want to keep going too long. Okay, I think if I'm correct, I think I just have two left. Let's do them quickly. It is better to advance our self-actualization as a husband and wife by debating our ideas of truth, or better to not upset one another by doing so, and instead finding a compromise while avoiding the intense debate? I think you need to debate that. Yesh v'yesh. Yesh v'yesh. There are people, I think that there are some people who can have good, healthy discussions of exchanges of ideas which will only enrich their relationship. And sometimes people have a very difficult time communicating or communicating about a specific subject. You know, sometimes people can have great discussions about different kinds of things, but some things they can't. If you can have a discussion which will bring you closer together, then that's great. Right? Dibur is the, you know, conversation is the great connector. But if you know that you can't have a conversation or that conversation, so then I think finding the compromise would be a great idea. Regarding loneliness, how do I respond when my spouse spends hours going out at night to the mall? When I ask him or point out he's been gone a long time, he says, I'm not in any hurry. The waiting for him to come home is lonely. But when I question why he is gone, he can get angry or defensive. What is the best way to ask for attention? It's a hard question, and the best I could suggest is just perhaps going back to our closing point, which is that perhaps the best way to ask for attention is to provide attention. Someone who needs to get away a lot is perhaps not so comfortable, doesn't feel so attended to where they are, or may feel that the house is just a place of challenge and burden. Yes, it's their job to give attention, but it's our job to give them attention. When people come to talk about a relationship, you know, each one could come and start and say, he's not doing this, he's not doing that, he's doing this, he's doing that, she's not doing this, she's not doing that, she's doing this, she's doing that. And, you know, usually when that happens, I feel like, okay, good, it's good, you each told me what the issues are. Now, from now on, let's not talk about what they should do. Let's talk about what you can do. Because that's really, it's our job to look out for the other. And generally speaking, it's not always the case. I don't want to be, completely rose-colored and glasses, but generally speaking, when a person sees that their spouse is taking the initiative and looking out for them and trying to address them and their needs and making the effort to do so, they appreciate it and they begin to respond by reciprocating. So perhaps that's the place to start. Thank you very much for your time, for your attention.